GoDaddy.com. Use the code BLU139 to get 10% off any combination of purchases at GoDaddy.com. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1380, July 22nd, 2010.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Humboldt, Tennessee. Humboldt is really just outside of Jackson, Tennessee. And Jackson, Tennessee is about, I don't know, roughly 80 miles or something like that east of Memphis. So, let's see. There was no podcast last night. Night before last, I was there at the Marietta Terminal. They'd worked on my truck. And so the next day, I don't know. I thought that they would come out and, since they had worked on it the night before, I figured they'd come out early in the morning and do the oil change. And they didn't. So I woke up, I don't know, it was probably around noon or so yesterday. And I just assumed, well, they must have, the guy probably forgot or whatever. And so I, rather than just keep sitting there, I finally, the dispatcher was wondering if I was ready to go, and I finally said, yep, I'm ready to go. And so I found an empty trailer and hooked onto it, and, and then, probably around... it was probably 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Here comes this guy. Well, I'm ready to do your B service, which is the oil change. And, I had to tell him, well, I've got to be in Gainesville, Georgia at 9:30. Can you get it done? Can you do it quick enough where I can get up there by then? Nope. So it was within 1,000 miles. It's not exactly on the mileage yet where it's due, so they'll usually do it if it's within 1,000 or 2,000 miles. So I'll just have to get it done later. But they did fix... it's doing better as far... He fixed a couple of things, It's doing better as far as the engine popping. It still will do it a little bit, but it's much better than it was. So that was, and then there was also this air leak. Whenever you turned the engine off, the air would leak down pretty quickly. And that was getting worse and worse, and, that had to be fixed. So those two things were fairly critical. And then the mirror, I've got a right, the right mirror, the main, the mirror on the outside of the truck is remote controlled from the driver's side. And for some reason, just before that, it had it would move vertically, but it wouldn't shift horizontally. So you got that fixed. So I'll just have to take it in soon to either that terminal or a different one, and get the oil changed. And so I don't know. Most of those. Shops seem to be painfully slow about the work, and they seem to do good work. Once you get the thing in there, they seem to do good work, but they do seem just painfully slow about getting the truck in the shop in the first place, and then they're pretty slow about getting the work, getting it done. So, but that's, I don't know, that's just, of course, that's from my perspective, because I'm, usually I'm just sitting there, waiting, kind of cooling my heels. And, from their perspective, they're overworked. Plus, they've got a kind of a bureaucratic system to go through. So, it would not be an easy job to just, to be a, any kind of a truck mechanic. That's not exactly an easy job. So, I don't know. But, so in any case, I'll just have to, probably after I've taken my time off, because I did tell him I wanted to be home by the 25th, which is just a few days from now. And once I come back after my time off, then I will tell him, hey, I need to go into a shop and get the B service done. So just do it that way. I've made a decision. I've been to all of the, in the past, I've made it to all of the portable media expos, especially the first three, of course, were in Ontario, California, and I was fortunate enough back in 2005 to get to that very first one there at Ontario, and then, 2005, 2006, 2007 were all at Ontario, and those were just really great events. Really enjoyed those, because from a social networking perspective, those were spectacularly successful. And then in 2000, let's see, so we had 5, 6, and 7. So 2008, they moved it to Las Vegas, same organizers. And that one, I don't know, there was a lot of podcasters didn't come to Las Vegas. There was, I'd say, very few listeners actually showed up. Whereas in Ontario, there was always a number of listeners that would actually show up from the LA area, because of course that's a huge area, and San Diego. So the whole Southern California, so they would show up, and plus a lot of local people would simply show up out of curiosity, I guess. So, those were always, when I had it in Ontario, they, from a social networking perspective, those were really successful events, and they were becoming more successful as, each year went on. And then they moved it to Las Vegas, and then, so in 2008, there weren't as many people attending. Some podcasters didn't come because they just didn't want to come to Las Vegas, I guess. And, and then I went again in 2009. And, then, of course, the original promoters had sold that, or whatever their arrangement was, to Blog World. So they just took it and they made it part of Blog World instead of, it's Blog World New Media Expo. And so in 2009, there were even fewer podcasters that showed up. There were some people that I knew, and it was cool to hang out with people. But it just wasn't the same. By any stretch of the imagination, it just was not the same. And so I've always been right up front about why I would attend those. It was from the social networking perspective, I never did pay to go through any of the sessions, so, because that really didn't interest me. I'm sure I could have probably learned something, but that's not what interested me about it. And, from the organizer's perspective, from the very first, they were trying to push sort of the business end of podcasting and make it a business type thing. And I don't know how well that worked, actually. I don't think, if it was successful, it was minimally successful, and so I think that there was potential if they could have continued to build up, you know, really kind of concentrate on the social networking aspect of it, then business would have eventually came out of that. But then again, maybe they couldn't sustain it in Ontario. I don't know. So, in any case, what I've decided, I was really disappointed. I enjoyed going in 2009, but to Las Vegas. But I was really kind of disappointed with the Blog World New Media Expo event itself. And so, what I've decided to do this year, I've got vacation time. I've got 3 weeks vacation time. So what I've decided to do is just skip the Blog World New Media Expo and instead go to the Consumer Electronics Show in early January. And so if I have 3 weeks of vacation, and so I've figured out how that I can, if they get me home on the, let's say, the 24th of December, which is the day before Christmas, then I'll start my vacation on the 25th, and then just have several days there at home, and then at the appropriate time drive out to Las Vegas, and then the CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, happens, I think, what was it? The 9th through the 12th, January 9 through January 12, I believe, were the dates. I'd have to look again. And then that'll give me enough, with all those days, that'll give me enough time to be there during CES, and then drive home, and then, basically go back to work. So, the CES, I don't know, I've watched a lot of the CES coverage. There's always a lot of media there, and they're always showing all the different gadgets and prototype gadgets and what have you. And those, $120,000-$130,000 people end up showing up for the CES. It's a giant. It's just really a giant thing that happens every January in Las Vegas. And so I think that would be really, if I'm going to go to Las Vegas, I think that would really probably interest me more than going, trying to go to that Blog World New Media Expo. So, and I can only go to one of them. I can't really take the time off to do both of them, so, and be able to go to Las Vegas. So I'm, just skip the Blog World New Media Expo this time, and, because it's just not the same. Not to say that, I don't want to denigrate it and say that it's bad. If somebody, feels like they want to go, and, then they should by all means go to it. I don't want to downgrade it. I don't want to, poo-poo it in any way. But for me, it's just not the same as what it was. And I think CES is probably going to be a lot more fun, at least for me. And it's not, different, if I'm going to spend the time there, then that should be, looking at all the gadgets and what have you should be more interesting. So that's what I'm going to do, or at least that's the plan. So, anyway, I've got a couple of pieces of audio feedback. Actually, I've got several pieces of audio feedback. The first one I'm going to play is from Ian. And so here's Ian.
Good morning, Tom. I was interested to hear about your dryer. My wife has always had the theory that the dryer should be off when we're out of the house. And now I can see that that's probably a good idea. We let the dishwasher or the washing machine keep going. But the dryer at 4,500 watts could do a lot of damage if it got heated up like the way you're talking about. So thank you for the warning, and it's a good idea to turn it off when you're not at home.
All right, well, thank you, Ian. And obviously, I think it's probably a good idea. Now, you know, in years past, even up until recently, there are times when I would start the dryer and leave the house and not think a thing about it because the dryer, you know, worked fine. I had that same dryer for 33 years. And as I, you know, said before, I've had it worked on. You know, people come and work on it a couple of times, two or three times over the years. And it just, you know, dryers are pretty simple devices. But they do have a heating element in them. And obviously, if that motor seizes up, then you got a problem. You know, if the thing's sitting there running, you've definitely got a problem. So, I think from now on, I'm just, you know, that's probably a, you know, just a, even though I got a new dryer now, it's probably a good idea just to make sure that, I don't leave the thing running when I decide to leave the house. You know, it's, because I, you know, it is using a lot of power, and, if, you know, the remote chance that something goes wrong, and it's, you know, you can get into trouble. Now, I've actually heard stories, and I'm sure that every possible appliance could cause some kind of a fire if you leave it on. Now, I have heard stories where washing machines eventually catch on fire for whatever reason. I'd say probably anything with a motor in it that, you know, could potentially, a bigger motor could potentially catch on fire, you know, if the thing seized up or whatever. So you take a risk, I guess, you know, because with your house being wired with electricity, there is a risk. But even if you don't have electricity, you know, you've still got a risk. You know, this lightning could strike your house and catch on fire. Or if you don't have electricity and you're heating with wood, obviously that's really a big fire hazard. If you've got some kind of wood fireplace, which I actually do have a fireplace. I haven't used it really in years. It's really a waste. You know, the things look pretty and what have you, but they really aren't, unless, I guess, depends on how they're designed, but they're, wood is really kind of an impractical way of heating your house. You know, obviously it would work if you had to, but, you know, so I do have a fireplace, but I haven't used it. I don't know. I haven't used it in several years. And, but obviously a fireplace could, you know, potentially could really cause trouble. But a clothes dryer is, you know, at that wattage, it probably is a good idea just to not leave it running whenever you leave. I don't know. Over the years, I've never really had any problem with any kind of appliance that was kind of, you know, that was actually, could be a threat as far as getting too hot. Been pretty lucky, I guess. So, anyway, I ended up with a new one. So, I don't know. Toasters, I don't make toast. I'm not a toast person. Coffee pots, electric coffee pots. I don't drink coffee, so I don't. I know people are always paranoid about unplugging the coffee pot and unplugging the toaster. Don't leave the toaster on or the coffee, especially the coffee pot, because you know people have their coffee and the coffee pot keeps it warm and what have you. And so I don't. as I say, I don't eat toast. I will eat it, but it's not just a priority, you know, so it's not something I have to have. So it's, if I'm left to my own devices, I just don't eat toast. You know, I don't make it at home. You know, I'll eat it in a restaurant, but toast just isn't a big priority for me. And since I avoid coffee because it gives me headaches, it's not the caffeine. There's something about coffee that'll give me a kind of a pre-migraine event, and I'll get kind of a mild throbbing headache afterwards. So I stay away from, you know, I just stay away from coffee. So, you know, I'm not drinking coffee, so I don't have to worry about leaving a coffee pot plugged in or what have you. But any kind of appliance like that has some sort of heating element in it is probably, you know, a heating element, you know, and you combine it with moving parts, it's probably a little bit of a threat, I would think. So, anyway, thank you, Ian. And so I've also got an audio comment here from Bruce, a.k.a. Mr. Gadgets. And this is a longer comment. It's about 18 minutes and 38 seconds. So I haven't listened to this at all. I probably will end up doing a stop-start on it. Possibly. I don't know. We'll find out. So here is Bruce.
Thomas, it is Bruce, otherwise known as Mr. Gadgets, here in Kansas City. And I will try this again, not that you've heard either of the other ones. I tried to record something on the one episode I'm going to start with once and screwed up the recording. So I talked a long time, but it didn't record anything. And last night I tried it, but a huge storm came through town. And I decided to pay more attention to my driving, and there was too much lightning and thunder. You may have heard something about that because it threw a United plane around, literally, and had to land early instead of going all the way to Los Angeles. They landed in Denver and had some people that got hurt on it. Very bad kinds of things. I wanted to talk specifically, at least to start with, about your episode from, last week sometime, I think it was. I don't think it's been that long, where you talked about a little culture and you played a little bit of La Traviata. La Traviata is a Verdi opera. Verdi and Puccini are my operas of choice. Not sure that many people know online, but the reason I got into technology originally was back when I was in music school and was interested in working in the recording studio. They talked a lot about digital audio, and I taught myself computers to be ready for all that digital audio. Of course, by the time digital audio really came, I knew too much about programming computers to do other useful things in business to actually get into that professionally. But I have been making my way and making my living full-time in computers since the late 70s, always in microcomputers, always in the small computers, not the big iron. But when I was in school, my voice was my instrument, and I am actually making great use of my music degree. I have a degree in music and am a fully trained and qualified opera singer. An operatic tenor, in fact. I did keep a little bit of a foot in the water, and the local opera company here, I did more than 20 seasons part-time, you know, with the opera company here, doing minor roles and things like that. So I like Verdi and Puccini. The Traviata is a bit on the coloratura side, on the Baroque side of things. For those who don't understand those terms, and you may have familiarized yourself with some of these terms, Tom, but the Baroque is, if you remember that part in Amadeus, when they were talking about Mozart's music and they were trying to explain to the Archduke what was wrong with Mozart's music, and one of the musical impresarios says, "Too many notes, sire, too many notes." I do think it's interesting that young people nowadays think that they're inventing something new and different, and that they're so unique in that they are taking tunes and they're not just singing the tune as it was written, but they're embellishing it with all kinds of little vocalises, you know. They're not staying on the one note, but they're kind of noodling around with with that, because that was all the rage back in Mozart's time, you know. Nothing actually new. It's reinventing of something that's almost as old as Western music is. And I thought it was interesting, though, to go about a discussion of this, because you talked about culture in that show, and actually, I don't know if you realized it, but the entire show, the entire thing was a perfect encapsulation of culture. Every single topic that you talked about there was culture, including the cultural mores of people living with one another. The way that they speak is also a cultural more, and you can still see that to this day, not only in the African-American community in many cases, but also within the Italian-American community, for instance. And people who live in Little Italy or who have grown up within those societies still have a marked accent that marks them as having grown up in that community. Especially ladies who come from the states north of me, Minnesota, North and South Dakota, even a little bit in Montana when I made a recent trip up there. There are certain ladies that I hear a certain lilt in their voice that is a very distinctive upper Midwestern plain state kind of accent that I can detect. My chops are not as good as they have been. I spend a lot of time on the East Coast, especially the Boston area, because I work a lot with mutual funds, and there's a lot of mutual funds in Boston. So I've spent many a day and many a night in Boston, and interacting with people that are both from the northern shore of Boston and the southern shore of Boston. Now, it's very similar to the Missouri-Kansas line here that I live near, and I don't know that this is pronounced, since I know you're near the Oklahoma-Arkansas line, but I don't think the same kind of thing is as pronounced as that Missouri-Kansas line here. By and large, there's no typical kind of accent which indicates it, but if you were raised on the Missouri side, you don't move to Kansas, and likewise, if you were raised on the Kansas side of the line, you do not move to Missouri. Even though it is an arbitrary line, an arbitrary surveyor's line that goes south from a crook in the Missouri River and heads straight south towards Arkansas to delineate the rest of the difference between those two states, there's a marked difference in the people who are raised within one state or the other, and the only people you'll see who will be crossing that line are typically people who are from, not from these parts, who are from other states who have moved here, and they might move back and forth across that line. And similar to that, if you're from the northern shore of Boston, you do not move to the southern shore and vice versa, by and large.
Let me interrupt. Now, that's very interesting. See, I did not realize that was going on, actually. Now, I was born and raised in Kansas, but, you know, nowhere around Kansas City. My dad was a bridge construction foreman, and so we were moving constantly, but bunch of little small towns, and this kind of in this all over the state, but not really, I don't think anywhere close to Kansas City or the Missouri state line. But that's, I did not know that. Now, I knew that, in Kansas City in particular, I kind of got, back in the days when I used to listen to the radio, I kind of got the impression that people from Kansas City, Missouri, didn't want, they would actually say, you ask them where they're from, and they'd say, Kansas City, Missouri. They'd delineate it. They didn't want to think, they didn't want to be associated with Kansas City, Kansas. And I, it's kind of the wrong, actually Kansas City, Kansas is sort of the wrong side of the tracks. And I, if you go up there and look at it, you'll kind of know what I mean. And, but as far, Overland Park, Lenexa, Overland Park is, from what I've seen, is pretty upscale, so that's kind of an upscale part of the area. So I did not, but I didn't realize that there were, that the people that were native to there were not moving, from one side to the other. That's That's kind of weird. I'm going to have to think about that for a while. It would have something to do with sort of peer pressure. It would be revolving around some sort of peer pressure that would stop them from, and even in the Boston, you're talking about the two different shores and the people just not kind of moving from one to the other. And same type of thing. And I'm sure now that you mention it, that there's probably those types of things that are going on all over the country. We're just not aware of it. So I don't know. That's kind of a strange thing. I'm going to have to think about that for a while. Why would that be?
And there is a different accent for people who grew up north of Boston and those who grew up south of Boston. And when I am back in that, I cannot reproduce it myself, and I probably couldn't do it as well right now, but when I spend a lot of time there, I can detect whether somebody is from the North Shore or from the South Shore, because there's a slightly different Boston accent for each of those. There's also the Brahmin accent, the rich person's accent from Boston. John Kerry, presidential candidate and senator from Boston, has that Brahmin type of accent. The Kennedys, right, typically had that kind of Brahmin accent that was a little bit higher class accent. And this is also something that accents used to indicate to us, is the type of upbringing that we had, and likewise the type of schooling that we had, and then one's way of communicating verbally would indicate to you the class of the person, what type of schooling they had, what type of schools they went to, what kind of vocabulary they had. And it was a very telling type of thing, and it still does. The oldest joke around from the lexicologists, the experts on accents and on language, that are typified by Pygmalion, which then becomes My Fair Lady on Broadway as the musical version. And the old joke about that is, if you give them long enough, they'll be able to tell exactly where you're from. In fact, pre-World War II, and especially the media, the radio, has changed this quite a bit. It used to be that when you lived in the hills, similar to where you live down there, in the hills of Arkansas, my people, I'm a proud first-generation hillbilly out of the hills, but my parents both grew up in the Ozarks, not that far from the Arkansas line, at least much closer than I am here in Kansas City. And it used to be the people who lived in the hills were isolated from society and maintained their own way of speaking and their way of communicating, and that society really reflected the language that they spoke back in the 1600s when they first moved into those hills.
Now, let me interrupt once again. I always found it curious that our news media in particular, they all practice, no matter where they're from, unless they're from some local little podunk station somewhere, they all, especially the national media, they all practice kind of sounding like they're from Kansas. You look at it today. ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, so on and so forth. They all sound like they're from Kansas or Nebraska. They have a kind of a, I don't know what you'd call that. The accent thing has always been very interesting to me, because it would seem to me, and I'm sure it seems to everybody, that I don't have an accent that I can detect, but I can hear, because I've traveled all around the country, I hear different accents, and some of them are more subtle than others. Now, it's interesting, you go to place like, even Ohio, you get different parts of Ohio, kind of in that area in Indiana. And you can hear, you know, on certain words, you can hear a type of accent, and, you know, it's more subtle, but it's there. You know, and then, of course, if you go to the south, anywhere, you know, to Kentucky, Tennessee, you get a, you know, a more of a southern type of accent, or Arkansas, or, you know, in certain parts of Texas, you get, you get different types of accents. But I've always found it kind of, you know, it's an interesting topic, because it doesn't seem to me that I have an accent, but I'm certain that someone that's, let's say they're from Australia or they're from Britain, they'd say, well, we don't have an accent, you've got the accent. So, but now, the language thing is, it's interesting. It's very interesting. Why do, you know, where do these things come from, and why do they, you know, obviously kids, you know, when people have kids, the kids pick up on, you know, the way their parents speak, the kids pick that up, and they you know, perfectly replicate, you know, as far as how to pronounce various words. But, you know, of course, as you say, the television has kind of, television and radio have probably homogenized that to some extent. But, I don't know. It's an interesting topic. And again, you know, language, the way people speak, does, you know, I hate to say it, it does kind of delineate class, you know, the class of person. And, you know, you just look at the British, you know. There's all these different, you know, Cockney and so on and so forth. And the really upper class British people have what's called a received accent. So they go to school to learn to pronounce words in a more refined way. And so they actually learn the accent, you know, instead of, it's not a natural thing. They actually learn, you know, maybe they'd learn it from their parents if their parents already had learned to speak with the quote-unquote received accent. But, I don't know. It's, kind of strange, you know, when you think about, well, how could someone, you know, because it's almost the received accent, quote unquote, that the British upper classes have, is all, you know, it sounds pretty and what have you, but it almost, some of it almost sounds pretentious, and you know, so I don't know. It's an interesting thing, and it probably comes about. It probably originates in the same ways, and it probably has some of the same dynamics that because I've talked about the so-called black accent, the American black accent, that that's one way that they, a huge way that people use to identify each other, you know, if they're from the same, almost the same tribe, in a way. You know, not just the black people, but the, you know, people in different states and so on and so forth, or different regions. They kind of use that to identify each other. And, you know, but the black people in the inner city, or, you know, are just black people, you know, nationally, just the American blacks, they have a certain way of pronouncing words, and you can, you know, you hear them on the radio, or you hear someone, you know, you hear a voice in the way they speak and the way they're pronouncing words, and you can immediately tell, usually. But if some of them, you know, lose that accent, like Clarence Thomas, the Supreme Court Justice, for example, you know, you can listen to him talk, and he sounds like any other, you know, just a typical American. You can't detect the fact that he's black. There's no black accent, and the black community, you know, look how they treat him. You know, he's Oreo and Uncle Tom, white on the inside, black on the outside, all kinds of ridicule, and of course part of that is politically motivated as well. But I think overall people tend to divide along lines of language, and I've talked extensively in podcasts in the past about this topic, because it's a topic that's always fascinated me. Probably every community in every state has, if you can detect it, they've got some kind of a language that's common to that region. And the same thing happens in professions, in different jobs. You get a type of language that develops, you know, which may or may not, you know, it certainly includes certain words that you almost have to be on the inside to understand it, you know, kind of in the, you know, and that's one of the ways that people use. Let's say that you're interviewing for some, to be, you know, for whatever type of job, and one of the ways that, you know, that they determine that you really are what you say you are is by the way you speak, and if you can speak the vocabulary and you know, kind of speak the language, speak the lingo. And I think that in part that, you know, a particular language and language styles develop to kind of people, you know, to give people some sort of an identity. You know, even though it, in, you know, it's probably kind of an externalized identity, you know, it's certainly probably in the case of a, you know, some kind of a language that develops around a job, it's sort of an externalized identity, but it's a kind of an identity nonetheless that people kind of end up picking up on. And, you know, but it's, you know, in the case of the black community, especially in the inner cities, it ends up, you know, the identity that they have, it's kind of an externalized identity, but they end up transmitting that to their kids, and, you know, it's an identity that's kind of based on resentment, and that gets pounded into the kids, and they kind of get brainwashed with it, and then if one of them dares to begin to deviate from that, all of the others naturally jump on them. And I would say that probably happens in the case of not wanting, you know, someone that was close to the Kansas line, you know, not moving, you know, that was born and raised on the Kansas side, not moving to the Missouri side, and vice versa. There has to be some peer pressure that's there, you know, some kind of subtle peer pressure that says, you're on this side, you stay on this side, and vice versa. And that's absurd. It's absolutely ridiculous. So, if you think about it logically and objectively. So, anyway, let's go ahead and listen to some more of Bruce's comment here.
The old islands out there that are the headwater islands off of the coast of the Atlantic. Until radio came along and kind of universalized the accent, and everybody in communications went for that kind of neutral accent of the Midwest, because it's not that we don't have an accent here, but everybody can understand us. Whereas you put somebody from Boston talking to somebody from Dallas, Texas, for instance, there might be a lot of talking going on, but I'm not sure how much communication, right, is going on there. And that kind of has knocked off the corners, if you will, and rounded out, and everybody speaks in a uniform kind of a fashion, much more so than they used to. And in the old days, a lot of mores were different pre-war than after the war in the UK, but it used to be in the old days that two people could come from two different villages 10 miles apart and could hardly understand one another. their accents were so profoundly different than one another, just from those two different communities, physically, geographically close to one another, but practically speaking a different language in terms of the accents that were involved. The old joke is, oh yes, okay, you live in Barton. Oh, in Barton on High Street. Okay, talk a little farther. Okay, in Barton on High Street above the greengrocer. Okay, a little more. Okay, in Barton on High Street above the greengrocer at the back on the flat on the left. And that was the joke, is you can get to that level of detail just by how someone speaks. But a lot of that has gone away because of media and because of the radio and the television and the kind of universal way that people speak. But, you know, that aspect of the show, every single aspect of the show was about culture, the culture that we live in and the mores that we then get from that cultural basis that are the basis for how we live, how we interact with the world, how we treat one another in the world. I had a opportunity to go to Bangkok for a month about 2 years ago, before all this trouble in Thailand came up, but back after the prime minister that all the trouble is about was ousted. So the first military coup had actually happened there, but they weren't having all the difficulties they are now. And I spent a month at our office there in Bangkok, and it's a fascinating thing to do. I've had an opportunity to travel to Europe, and, you know, that's not that much different than us. You know, our culture is really derivative of that culture, and we come from that kind of Judeo-Christian background, and those things that I see there are not remarkably different. I can see where they come from, right? Where rugby, you know, becomes football, and where cricket becomes baseball, and things like that. And in Bangkok, since it's a Buddhist culture, it's very interesting because a lot of the things I see are, you know, businesses that I know are international businesses. And they have McDonald's, and they have, you know, Starbucks, and they have all the kinds of things here. But underlying that is a fundamentally different culture than ours because of that Buddhist background, rather than the Judeo-Christian background that we live in. And I could see those differences, and it was very interesting for me from a cultural basis to see the differences in those and how those change. And anybody who works with Asia will tell you that there are differences in how you interact with people there because of those cultural differences. And it affects the way that you do business, and it affects the way that you act. I had somebody also that never neglect how language affects your thought patterns. I had somebody who is a Japanese, a person from a Japanese company that we were working with in a translation once, because I used to work international and do translation projects, and he mentioned to me once in passing that he quite enjoyed English because there are certain things that he could express in English that would just be too difficult to have that conversation in Japanese. So the way that your language affects the way that you think and how you can interact with one another is also an important aspect to keep in mind in terms of our interpersonal relationships and our culture, our mores, our way that we interact with each other and thusly interact with the world. One last comment I'd like to make is about the whole aspect of the operas that you chose. Another of the operas that is from that Baroque kind of way of thinking is Rossini. Rossini is another one of those Baroque kind of composers with the coloratura, the heavy ornamentation. And Rossini and Mozart both chose as a subject matter one of the most underlying anarchistic, and when I say anarchistic, I mean against having a king, right? In the true anarchy. In other words, not having a formal government that is headed by the king. And one of the primal underlying social mores that happened during that time frame was books about Figaro, right? And Rossini wrote about Figaro, right? And then Mozart wrote The Marriage of Figaro. And these Figaro novels were passed around almost underground. They were printed and passed around amongst people who were beginning to think in a free thought manner and not think of everything belongs to the king and the king is ordained by God and everything comes through the king and we live by the largesse of the government and of the king. And so the underpinnings of what became the American Revolution actually tie back to that music that you were playing. People don't learn these kinds of things in history class nowadays. And thusly, they are doomed, as that phrase goes, to relive these things if they do not understand the history from which they come. And then for those who are saying, oh, I don't like all this fancy music, and I don't, you know, really care for all of this, you got to remember that most of what Mozart wrote and Rossini wrote was not written for the upper crust, the way we think of as opera today. Yes, there were always very rich people who were the benefactors who would keep the artists in the money they needed to be able to write the music and the theater that they were writing. But notice that Mozart had no qualms about doing something as undermining and as countercultural as writing a novel about Figaro, even though it was probably someone of royal blood who was paying and was his patron for that portion of his life. Okay? So ever the artist being that cultural and countercultural movement underneath things and the secret meaning of things were always part of this, but most of these were folk opera, right? Most of these, this was the musical theater of its time. This was like going to see a show, a musical theater show, as people would do now for an entertainment. And this was designed for the common man. This was designed as a musical theater kind of piece for the common man. And another outgrowth of all this, of the orchestras, is not only the basis for Western music and the chord progressions that we are familiar with, but also the fact that the violin was so popular and then it became an instrument that everybody wanted to play and lots of musicians were playing them, and thusly those instruments became cheaper and could be used in the folk music, and then those chord progressions and that folk music tradition then becomes the music that goes into those same hills that I'm talking about where the people were so isolated and were playing the music from the 1600s. And then that all becomes, along with the guitars and the other instruments, the banjo with the African influence from that, then becomes the country music, which then becomes the blues music, and also then becomes the rock and roll music that you all love so much. And these are all intertwined, intertwingled, and are all part of our common culture if we just were taught about how these things are all connected. Keep up the great work. I hope that storm isn't storming over you now, and hope the truck is okay. This has gone on for way too long, I'm sure, and I can't even guarantee that it is any more succinct than the first two times that I tried to record it. Okay? We'll talk to you later. You be careful out there. Bye now.
Okay, well, thank you, Bruce. That was really interesting. You're right. We're not taught history, you know, and it's certainly, you know, when I was in school in the 60s and the early 70s, they didn't teach anything like that, and, you know, they didn't teach anything that I was really curious about. I don't know that I was really curious about music in those days, but they really didn't, you know, the school system, you know, they just, and so if it was that bad in the 1960s, I can only imagine what it's like today, but, you know, that's an, I don't know, that's an ongoing problem. But that's really interesting, you know, how different people will take something and then kind of turn it into something else. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play that, you know, one of the La Traviata pieces that I played, I don't know, I guess it was several podcasts ago. So here that is. Okay, so that is from La Traviata, and Act 1, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Libiamo or Libiamo. I can't speak Italian, obviously. So, but in any case, as I was saying, that it's really fascinating how people take different parts of different things and kind of mix them up or mash them up is a popular term that people use today, mashups. But in this case, it's kind of a cultural mashup, and we don't really, unless we really think about it, we don't really, the average person is just kind of living in their little world, and they don't think about these things, and they think that it's all kind of compartmentalized and it's all sort of separate from them, and they shouldn't like the opera music or classical music in general. There's a lot of people that just, they claim, oh, I don't like that stuff, or so-called highbrow stuff, and I don't know. I've always been able to, I like almost any kind of music if it's good. There's, you know, I'll listen to almost anything. But the classical, I don't know, the classical stuff, you know, the major composers and what have you, most of that is very intricately put together. And it, you know, if I had to choose, you know, if I could only have a certain, you know, either one, let's say classical music versus popular music versus whatever other kinds of music, and I can only choose one to listen, you know, that was my only choice to be able to listen to, it would probably be the classical, you know, just classical music in general, because, you know, what I've found over the years is the classical pieces, you can continue to listen to them over and over again, and there's a lot, it seems that there's a lot more, well, certainly there's a lot more going on in a piece of classical music, you know, with an orchestra playing. There's certainly a lot more going on musically, you know, in that kind of music. But there's more opportunity to listen to it over and over again and hear parts of it that you know, in different, you know, as you listen to a piece of music over and over again, it's interesting because typically you'll become, you know, it works with me. I can listen to a piece of music the first time and then I listen to it over again. It's almost as if I kind of become more fond of it. And then if you keep listening, especially with the classical music, you keep listening to it, and then you can kind of begin to detect how it's put together and so on and so forth. So, but, you know, and then as far as as far as the cultural stuff and the accents and all that, again, I think that's a lot of that you're describing, you know, where people wouldn't move from Kansas to Missouri or Missouri to Kansas. Now, probably it would be, you know, if they're close to the line, is probably, you know, because I'm assuming that someone from western Kansas wouldn't know about that, and let's say they'd move to Missouri or whatever, and I'm sure that type of stuff happens. But it's probably close to these, you know, these imaginary lines, you know, whatever they are. It might be a railroad track, because that happens in towns if you think about it. Someone's from the wrong side of the tracks or whatever, or someone's in from one part of town to another part of town, and so you have these imaginary boundaries. And I think again it a lot of that is sort of based around language and the way people speak. Now, you know, of course, you can, in North America, you can throw in the Canadians. Ian, I know, is up there listening in Ottawa. They, you know, the Canadians, unless they're from Quebec or something, a lot of the Canadians, you'd swear that they sounded like Americans, except for, you know, the way they pronounce certain words, like about. About. now, why? You know, why is there a kind of a Canadian, you know, this recognized sort of Canadian accent? And, you know, it's kind of a strange thing, you know, because we're very similar, speak the same language, same, you know, origination from the European, from the British culture, yet end up with different, you know, slightly different accents. You know, it's kind of a weird thing how that works. So, anyhow, they're unloading my truck now. It seems that it's kind of a slow process. Every once in a while, I kind of feel them coming into the trailer and, you know, with a forklift. And probably what's happening, there's one person working on it, and they're taking one pallet out at a time, and then once they get it out, they're having to, break it down, you know, and probably restack it on different pallets, and so that's probably why it's taking a while. So anyway, I've got, we're at 65. I guess we can go on. Since there wasn't a podcast last night, I'll just make this one a little bit longer. I've got some more comments from Scott, scottpodcast.com. And this one's about 6 minutes and 56 seconds. Don't know if I'll do a stop start on it. But so anyway, here is Scott.
Hi, Tom. This is a couple of comments in one. The first one doesn't have to do with your podcast, but with a show you kind of referred on to me, which was about these small companies who are globalizing, as they like to call it, anything but outsourcing. They said, no, it's insourcing. No, this is globalization, and they don't want to admit to what it is. But it was these companies that were, a couple of illustrations there had to do with computers, you know, developing applications for telephones and things like that. And, you know, I was thinking at one time that, gee, you know, maybe this new telephone computer thing is going to be the next boom. We'll have a job boom in it. And now that I hear this, I realize that was pretty silly. It's not going to be any job boom, because they're going to give the jobs to people in other countries who will do them for next to nothing. So, yet another loss for the value of American labor.
Okay, now let me interrupt. There is actually nothing stopping Americans from, we have access to the internet. There's nothing stopping Americans from writing these small applications for telephones and selling them, and there are plenty of Americans that are involved in that. The key, I think, is to come up with some idea or something that's really useful. But then the problem becomes, these applications for phones, especially I think with the iPhone, and I'm sure that it's probably true with the Android as well, at least with some people, they've got, it's almost like they're hit records or whatever, and they're popular for a while, and people, they may buy them, especially on the iPhone, because it seems like all these applications are for sale on the iPhone, or in the iTunes store for the iPhone and the iPod Touch and the iPad now. Whereas with the Android, there's some that are for sale, but there's a larger percentage of them, at least up until this point. I think they said the other day there were 70,000 applications available for Android in the Android marketplace. The majority of them seem free, and then some of them are paid. Now, I have yet to pay for any. I'm still kind of looking and listening to different things, talking about different Android applications. And, of course, there's some applications that there's an Android version and an iTunes version, or an iPhone version, iPod Touch version, iPad version. So, but there's nothing stopping people from doing that. You know, the thing with that's kind of happening with the these little small applications is, it can be just like a one-man show type of thing, where, you write your application, and if you've got a kind of an interesting idea that kind of catches on with people, right idea at the right time, then you can make some money out of it. So, and there have been some people, there have been stories, of course, where kids even have been able to write applications like for the iPhone that really generated some serious money for them. So there's nothing stopping people from doing that. The phone thing in particular, but it's not something that really lends itself to a large company that they've got a whole stable of programmers where everybody goes to work in this big, huge, giant building and writes applications. That's not that's just not the nature of what's happening on the internet today, selling these little applications. It's kind of very similar to the way independent musicians are able to write music and sell their songs or sell ringtones. You know, Jeff Smith is a good example. TheJeffSmith.com. TheJoeff. I think is the way it's spelled, Smith.com. He is really prolific with ringtones and podcast jingles and podcast intros and what have you. And he's actually had some albums that he's released for sale. He's kind of using this as a side business, and he's been, I don't know, I think he's been probably fairly successful with it. So, and there are plenty of other people that are doing the same thing. They're kind of selling their music, you know, directly to people. And so you end up with a kind of a one-man type of thing, and it's not a giant, it's more of a diversified thing where it's just individuals here and there, as opposed to some giant industry that, you know, where all these people are employed. So the phone thing, there's nothing stopping people. If they can come up with, you know, you can come up with an idea for an application, and you've got the program, you develop the programming skills to actually write it, then, you know, you can make some money with that. But it's not, you know, that's more of a diversified thing. So someone that's in India or wherever they're at, obviously they're able to take advantage of, you know, because it is the internet.
That nobody wants it because they perceive it as too expensive. I don't know. I still think that we need to rethink this, this whole strategy. Because ultimately, as I've said many times, what happens when you do as much of this as you possibly can, when you find people or, if you will, things to do the job for the lowest possible cost, which I said would be like if you had robots, and the robots could even make more robots. Well, then, when you can get the job done for nothing, now you got a product to sell, and it cost you nothing to make other than the materials, and maybe even that didn't cost anything because robots made that. I don't know. But if you could make a product for free, let's say, that you've been making for some kind of a cost, and you could do it by simply getting rid of all the labor that you used to have to pay to do it, well, what happens when you go to sell it, which is the other side of the equation? What happens is that the people that were doing all these jobs, not just at your company and others who are doing the same thing because they have to, nobody has any money to buy the product. The system works from both ends. The money has to go around for it to work. And I got to thinking about the whole thing about Germany and how they, you know, how Germany has this high tax rate. And thinking how some people say, oh, that's horrific, you know, 50% tax rate and on and on and on. But what if we did the same thing here? And what if we did a 50% tax rate? And what if it was 50% for the people who were more wealthy? It was, you know, 40% for people a little less wealthy and so forth. Now, the problem is that people with wealth often just keep the money sitting there. They don't move it around. They don't make more jobs. They don't, you know, they don't get it back into the economy. Well, what does this do? It kind of grabs that money. Yes, it does. But what it actually does helps the rich because that money goes back, and even the stupidest person out there is going to spend it on something, and that something was probably made by people who were a little better off and owned companies and things like that. They actually benefited from the fact that they were being taxed. Because it's actually keeping them alive, it's keeping that money circulating around, as opposed to the other way, where it stops circulating around. It's kind of an odd thought. Anyway, that's one thing you can discuss. The other was, this is like a month-old podcast, and it was a story, Ian had this story about police who are cracking down on all kinds of mobile devices, no matter what they are. If you were using them, you're going to get it. Zero tolerance. And so if you're making a podcast going down the road, or it doesn't matter what, well, you know, they should go beyond that. They should, you know, the idea that you're listening to an MP3 player, well, what about you turn your radio on? That's next. What about you're conversing with the person in the car who's sitting next to you, or your kids? That'd be next. can't have kids or somebody next to you because that's distracting. Basically, it's all about avoiding distraction. Now, one thing that you said, well, they just want the money from the fines. You know, here in New Hampshire, I don't know about where you are, Tom, but have you ever gotten a fine? Who do you pay that fine to? Is it your police department? I got to tell you, here, it's paid to the state. It goes into the state coffers. In other words, it's money for the politicians to do something with. It isn't money for the police. They don't get anything out of it. They have to enforce the state laws.
Well, they do get something out of it. Because they feel like, you know, there's, you know, it's been documented over and over. There's a lot of policemen, especially in smaller towns and different, you know, in county and so on, and even the state police, you know, the state highway patrolmen. They feel like they you know, they're under some kind of pressure, even though oftentimes the state will say, oh, there's no such thing as ticket quotas and what have you. They're under pressure to generate revenue to, you know, in order to keep their jobs. They feel like they have to generate revenue, some way of generating revenue. And so there is that pressure on any kind of law enforcement officer, especially if it's traffic. They're under pressure to generate revenue, so that does exist. That they feel like they have to do something to generate revenue. They've got, and there have been plenty of cases where there are quotas that they do have to meet. Now they've tried to, you know, a lot of those different, especially the boss hog type little towns. They've been sued, and a lot of times people have been able to win and kind of beat that back. But nationally, there are plenty of little speed trap towns that try to generate revenue that way. I've talked about it a long time ago. There's this south of Fayetteville, Arkansas, kind of in between Fayetteville and West Fork. There's this little town of Greenland. It's just a little, you know, just a little tiny town that's basically, it's really part of Fayetteville, but it's just a little tiny town. And so it used to be when, before the freeway was there, Interstate 540, you know, if you were going to go south out of Fayetteville, you had to take U.S. Highway 71, the old U.S. Highway. And of course, there was quite a bit of traffic on it. And so people would, kind of speed through Greenland. And Greenland, they got one traffic light, and so they had, at one, you know, this is a town of maybe, I think they had maybe 600 people at the time. The population of Greenland was 600. But they had three policemen that were out there writing tickets. It was a speed trap. They had the speed in the town was kind of arbitrarily set low, so that you really had to kind of go through it slow. And of course, with all that traffic, people were just, you know, they were trying to zip through there. And so those cops, for a long time, you know, for years and years, that was kind of known as a speed trap. And those cops were writing their tickets, and the city of Greenland was benefiting from it, you know, kind of in a parasitic sort of way. But someone, they gave a ticket to somebody, and it's, I don't know, somebody sued them. I don't remember the story, the details of the story now. But they sued the city of Greenland, and they won, and Greenland was forced to raise their speed limit up to something more reasonable. And that was kind of the beginning of the end of Greenland. I don't think they have three policemen anymore. And then what ended up happening, a number of years later, that freeway was finally completed, and the only people that drive through Greenland now pretty much are just people that are going home or whatever, or that live out that way. And that got rid of all the through traffic. That's all on the freeway now. And you know, so they kind of lost their you know, it was kind of a they were looking at all these people going by almost as a revenue source. And that's kind of like, you know, it's sort of a more modern form of highway robbery. So anyway, let's go on and listen to some more of the rest of Scott's comment.
Whatever they may be, the laws are made by politicians for politicians, And in this case, the money that they get from them goes to the politicians. So, you know, that's an old misnomer. I got a feeling it's that way in most every other state, too. It's an old kind of a misconception that police like to, you know, get these fines because it makes more money for the police. It doesn't go to the police. It goes generally to the state.
Recently, I don't know, probably within the last year, Ohio... you know, Ohio has always had all kinds of highway patrolmen, and, you know, you go back way back in the 70s whenever they first imposed the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, ostensibly, you know, the nationwide 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, ostensibly to save fuel. Ohio was one of the few states that would actually write you a ticket if you were, I wasn't driving through Ohio in those days. But they would write you a ticket for going like 56 miles an hour. They'd actually write you a ticket for going 1 mile an hour over the 55 mile an hour speed limit. So Ohio has always had this, you know, a lot of highway patrolmen, and you know, I think they've become more lenient as they'll, you know, as far as, you know, you still don't want to speed through Ohio, but they become a little bit more lenient since then. But the Ohio highway patrolmen were against. You know, Ohio had this split speed limit, 65 for cars, 55 for trucks. And so the highway patrolmen, the Ohio highway patrolmen, were against the state getting rid of the 55, you know, that split speed limit on the interstates. And I think the federal government, I think, kind of forced them, because statistically, in states that have split speed limits for cars and trucks, statistically, there are more accidents and more highway deaths than if you have a uniform speed limit. And so, if you're going to have a speed limit, you don't want to have one that's split like that. Because, you know, the statistics are there. That if you've got a split speed limit, you're setting up thousands of inherent conflicts of speed. And but I don't know if there was some pressure from the federal government. Now, one state that still has their split speed limit is California, 70 miles an hour for cars and 55 miles an hour for trucks. And California is still stuck with that, and that's one of the I don't know, there's still some states that have some minor split speed limits, and then Ohio still has, on other freeways that are not interstate highways, they still have some cases where there's some split speed limits. But the Ohio highway patrolmen were against, you know, they were politically against the idea of getting rid of the split speed limit just on the interstates and, on the actual federal interstate highways. And why would they have an opinion? Why should a bureaucrat, you know, somebody that works for the state, they're not bureaucrats, but why should they have an opinion about it? Especially when statistically it's provable that if you have a uniform speed limit, whatever it is, that you're going to end up with fewer accidents and fewer deaths. And another example of that would be... people, let's say government employees, why should they have an opinion on whether, you know, we should, you know, because oftentimes there are government employees are against tax cuts. there was a few years ago, there was this law that went through, and then people actually had to vote on it as to whether or not, it was a, what they call it, homestead, it was in Arkansas, it was homestead tax exemption or something, where it was actually going to be a property tax cut statewide. And all of these school teachers, the public schools were, they were campaigning against it. Don't cut the taxes, it's going to hurt us. Why should they have an opinion? The schools are still in business. They've still got all kinds of money, seems like. So why should they have an opinion on whether there's a tax cut or not? But they feel like they're benefiting from it. See, and that's the whole thing. And then there are people that, all these people that are getting federal, some kind of government paycheck, you know, whether it's, you know, some sort of welfare or whatever it is, you know, or maybe some sort of disability, they're all against any kind of tax cuts. You know, because they feel like that, boy, if they cut the taxes, then they're, you know, we're going to get cut off somehow. So, you know, it turns, you know, people are almost like parasites. It kind of creates a parasitic, sort of a parasitic mentality.
Because the state was the law that they were crossing. The police are only enforcing that law. Now, there is a political aspect to this that I found out about. You know, this idea that police have quotas because they have to make a certain amount of money or whatever. There is kind of a quota, though, because they want to make sure that they're enforcing the law. They're graded by, you know, let's say if you're trying to keep the speed limit in your state at a certain amount, how many people are disobeying that law, how good are you at doing at changing people's patterns, etc. And they're graded by that. And so sometimes it's seen that if a police officer is lenient and he lets too many people go, there's this politics involved where they'll give him a desk job. I've actually talked with the police about this to find out this whole idea of fines. Do you have to give a certain amount of fines out? Does that benefit you in any way? And they're saying, no, it doesn't benefit them, but there is this politics involved that make it so that they really can't be a nice guy, because if they're seen as doing that, then they're seen as being ineffective as a police officer in getting people to kowtow to the law. And so the fact that you're giving a lot of tickets out means you're really making people toe the line. And so that's probably more to the point, is police politics, you know, like office politics, if you will, involved there. So, you know, I thought I'd mention, you know, that too, because that's something worth thinking about. You know, why is it that people are doing these fines? And I guess that's it.
Okay, well, thank you, Scott. Appreciate it, as always. So we're almost at, we'll see, we're 87 minutes, so we're almost 90 minutes. Better be cutting this off. Hope everyone is having a great week. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.